Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, in association with Henpicked, Wisdom of Women.
Jean Hanf Corlitz, author of The Devil in Webster. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you for having me.
Play on words a little bit, your title.
It is a bit, and it's actually a bit of a joke within the context of the novel, because as you know, many readers will know, The Devil in Daniel Webster is a rather well-known American short story, although I have noticed in the last couple of months, less well-known than I would have thought. It seems to be departing the canon in a way. But certainly when I was growing up, it was one of the most anthologized stories that I came across. It is a story by Stephen Vincent Benet, and it is about a New England farmer who makes a deal with the devil and then has to extricate himself from that deal and its consequences with the help of Nathaniel Webster, who was a great orator and jurist in the early 19th century.
Yes, and I didn't realize, I was moved to go back to that story because, again, it was something I read in high school. It was big, something that one read in high school. And one of the things I thought was interesting that emerged from it is that it was an extraordinarily patriotic story.
You know, I don't understand the story. And by the way, I've just realized I said Nathaniel Webster. It is Daniel Webster.
You have Nathaniel.
I have Nathaniel Webster in my version, yeah. It's a strange story. I don't really understand why it became such a big hit. It involves a trial in which the farmer has to argue for his soul and against all of these sort of dubious characters from the American past. And to be entirely honest, I don't really understand the story. But it's a great title, and it's a very American title. And
yes, it's very evocative.
This also, in its way, is a very American story.
Yes, an American story. Well, you tell us the story of the Devil in Webster.
Well, Webster is a college, Webster College. It's quite an old American college. It is the fictional counterpart, I guess you could say, of four or five American colleges and universities, including the one that I attended, Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. But it is a fictional college, and it is it has undergone a great sea change politically and environmentally, I guess you could say, ideologically, in the 1970s, when it transitioned from an all-white, all-male, all-conservative, all-Christian kind of B-rated college to a very multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-everything, left-leaning, progressive, liberal arts institution. And the agent of that transition was a very fiery young college president. So that's the setting for the Devil in Webster. But in the present, the president is a woman, the first female president. Her name is Naomi Roth, and she herself is a former campus radical. She has become a feminist critic and scholar. And through a series of unlikely events, she has become the president of the university. And all is going splendidly until something happens. A popular professor has been denied tenure. He happens to be African American. And suddenly there is a mystifying protest, student protest, taking place on the campus. And Naomi, as an old, you know, lefty herself, is initially not unhappy about this. She thinks it's great that students get out there and speak their minds, but it drags on and on and on, and they won't talk to her. It's not behaving like any protest she's ever been in or dealt with. And it is that difficulty that really sets the story in motion.
Yes, and one should say, I mean, as I was saying, you went to Dartmouth. I said earlier, I went to Vassar, similar institutions. And I think currently in the U.S. and here, there has been a drive towards liberal arts education, and then everybody should go to college, and that's a great thing. And the college system has remained, like the tenure system, sort of unchallenged. And yet it is institutionalized. These are institutions that are over 200 years old, which, you know, here in England isn't that long.
But, that's right. At Oxford, New College was founded in, what, the 15th century? Yeah.
But like that, these privileged, these are seen as privileged, entrenched institutions.
Yeah, although it is worth saying that, you know, these are the very institutions that are bending over backwards to try to be open to low-income students and students from backgrounds where they may be the first in their families to ever go to college. And this is, you know, what's so interesting about these institutions, they are old, even for America, you know, even for the world, they're old at several hundred years old. But they change. And if you go through a college as a student, you're there for 4 years, you're thinking about yourself and your friends and your teachers, and then you're gone. You have that tiny little snapshot of the life of the institution that you've been a part of. But if you're a professor or a staff member, or in my case, I've been a faculty spouse at Princeton for 30 years, you see the change within the institution as it shifts to the left, shifts to the right, educational policy, admissions policy, something as you know, incidental as my husband coming home and saying, I have a transgender student. He said, he was telling me yesterday, as a transgender student, that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. That certainly wouldn't have happened 30 years ago. The institutions themselves are like living organisms, and it's those pressure points that make the shifts that interest me, especially, you know, as I talk about in this book, that something made Webster College change. And Webster College is at another point of change, and it's that capitulation, that what Lillian Hellman described, cutting your conscience to fit last year or this year's fashions, which she may or may not have said, let's be honest. but that's another story. But those are the moments that interest me. Mm-hmm. So, there is nothing supernatural in this novel, although I personally will read any novel with the word devil in the title. That's just me. But
evocative.
It is, but there's nothing religious. It's really about the idea of the devil as the agent of destruction and influence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, influence is a key word. And the title itself is said by a character in the book who has a specific role for the college and for the book.
Yes, he's sort of the keeper of the college's history, and the joke is that he's writing a history of the college, and it's going to be called The Devil in Webster. So that became the title of the novel was sort of me having fun with just the whole concept of what's going on here. But what is going on here is this is a face-off between this very, very left-leaning female president and something that she thought she understood, which is how students behave and how to communicate with them. Making matters worse, her own daughter is a student at the college at this time, and she's centrally involved in this protest. So there's a whole kind of mother-daughter war that is going on within the context of this student protest.
Yes, and there's also the tone in the book sort of told the story for me as well, in that the tone starts off, like the novel, lighthearted, almost, mm-hmm. self-mocking, mm-hmm. certainly.
There is always so much to mock in an academic novel.
Yeah.
Get fired up with Radio Gorgeous.
But we also only see things from Naomi Roth, the president's viewpoint.
Yes.
So we only know what she knows.
Yes, it's very much her story.
It's her story. And we also sometimes, we don't know what she can't see sometimes as well.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah, and the tone does change throughout the novel and becomes, you know, as the consequences of things going, you know, as in anyone's life, the day, you know, for an easy evocative example, the day of September 11th, I do remember exactly where I was that morning. It was a beautiful morning, mm-hmm. remembered differently mm-hmm. later in the day.
Mm-hmm.
and remembered poignantly or whatever, you know, things are examined. She's sort of going back and examining things like when exactly did the tone change? And you sort of go back to moments and you think, I was such a blind, innocent idiot for being so lighthearted in that moment, mm-hmm. or not seeing the import of that moment, mm-hmm. until retrospect. And in that way, it almost seemed to me as a coming-of-age novel for her.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I guess so. One of the interesting things about, I suppose, any kind of art, making of any kind of art, but I think, especially for long fiction, is you spend years writing this thing, and then you finish it, and then, if you're lucky, you figure out what it is you've just done. Sometimes you have to wait for the critics to tell you what you've just done. For example, I've just been informed that this is a satire, a semi-satire, and not a satire. That's in three different reviews. I didn't set out to write any such thing, but one of the ways that I actually figured out what this book was about was when I had the small task of writing the jacket copy, which oddly enough, when I was an editorial assistant many years ago, that was my job, to write the jacket copy. And it's a tough little project to encapsulate a novel in a couple of paragraphs. But I was trying to do that for this novel, and I found myself writing something about how Naomi Roth has to come to terms with who she thinks she is and what she thinks she believes. And I realized that is the coming of age in this novel. Mm-hmm. It's her. She's in her late 40s or early 50s. I'm not exactly sure. I should know, but I don't. But she is only realizing that she is an adult now. She, like many of us, she thinks of herself as her younger self. And in her case, her younger self was on the ramparts protesting and agitating against the man. And now, guess what? She is the man. And yeah. that is a really rude awakening for her. But it is one that she not only makes, but acts on, not to give anything away in this book. Mm-hmm. She really becomes the college president that she's, in some sense, been pretending to be for the yes. last 10 years.
Yeah.
So that is what this book is about, at least as far as I'm concerned.
And as a person who, I think it's difficult for anyone who's in power or in the majority to see outside of their own experience. And as you say, she's both in that and yet thinks of herself as, you know, the young radical that she saw herself as a younger woman. And you see this progression. And as a reader, I went through the same progression, mm-hmm. seeing things through her eyes. We mentioned before, we all want to think of ourselves as good people.
Absolutely.
And that we would put our money where our mouth is. That we would, you know, that if we believe something, we would, you know, follow it to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. And then there's something, whether it happens with age, whether it happens with fear, with more to lose, with perspective. The young people here also have a very compelling, sort of tragically romantic narrative to hang on to,
and narrative, I think, compelling. Is the right word.
Yeah,
the young people who are protesting at Webster College are unhappy because this very popular professor has been denied tenure. He's African American, and he is a beloved professor. But what they don't know is that he's also a plagiarist. This is something that Naomi knows, that the tenure committee knows. This is the reason that he's been denied tenure, but she can't tell them this because the tenure process is very carefully cloaked in privacy and secrecy. If she in any way releases this information, she opens the institution to a very, very winnable lawsuit. And it's very tough to not be able to share that information. But, you know, part of her responsibility to the institution is not just kowtowing to the students, but protecting the institution. And that's what she has to do.
And treading that line, which she is forced to confront, not only through this protest, but in other avenues. Again, don't want to give too much away, mm-hmm. but she is forced to confront personal loyalties,
mm-hmm. prejudices.
Prejudices, and the job of an institution, and that is, and protecting the institution, and that's uncomfortable with us.
It certainly is.
That sounds like I was following orders.
Yes.
That's, you know, and it's lines we tread all the time.
Well, we can say, we're not, I don't think this is a spoiler because it's on page one, that her chief antagonist in the student protest is a student, a Webster student, who is a an immigrant from Gaza. He's Palestinian, and Webster is a college with a lot of extremely liberal students, many of them Jewish, and they see him as a visionary and a leader and an extremely charismatic young man. And Naomi sees him that way too. One of the first things she does is she goes and looks at his admissions application essay, and it's heartbreaking. She wants this young man to succeed and thrive at a place like Webster. She's proud of a place like Webster, that it can offer sanctuary and support to a student like this. The deeper she gets into this conflict, the more out of control she is. And things get very, very bad. What's so interesting is that I finished the first draft of this novel about 18 months ago. I sent it to my editor, and literally the next day I opened the New York Times, and it was as if this novel was on the front page of the New York Times. There had been a big protest at Yale. It was spreading all over the country to other colleges. There was an incident at the University of Missouri, which is in this book, had been written before it happened. It had this kind of moment of sort of zeitgeist grabbing, mm-hmm. and yet tragic unzeitgeist grabbing, because from that time to now, I mean, I knew I was looking at 18 months until this book was going to come out. But in the fullness of time and the madness of our current political moment in America, there is more protest on campus than ever. And of course, protest is always good. And it's also a rite of passage for students. You go away from home, you're leaving your family, you're going to a new place, you don't know anybody. This is the moment in our lives when we actually examine one hopes who we think we are and what we think we believe.
Yeah, and I think it's a real, I'm speaking of my own college experience, which is not universal, obviously, but it is a unique time in your life when you are surrounded almost entirely by your peers, mm-hmm. except for your professors. Mm-hmm. And that is, it is a unique and special time in your life. What I thought was interesting, Webster was, in the book, founded by a man who was sort of a missionary convincing Native Americans that they need Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And there, to me, there are very strong parallels with any immigrants,
mm-hmm.
and people seen as outside of white, mm-hmm. and outside of I guess majority, mm-hmm. circumstances, Hispanic, Palestinian, Native American, black, colored, people of color. And it also struck me, sorry, I'm a bit meandering, but it was very evocative to me that a story that ran through that is that I come from many generations of having gone to college.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew what the college experience was before I got there. I couldn't wait.
Mm-hmm.
I had an idea of that because already that tradition was in my family.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I know what I'm in for, in
mm-hmm.
a sense,
mm-hmm.
and I was supported in that vision.
Yeah.
Whereas if you are coming from one generation,
mm-hmm.
And there is now, again, in the last couple of years, I have heard of people really trying to support people in this. Because the idea of a liberal arts education, the value of a liberal arts education is getting lost.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And that is, it's like, well, this should just be vocational and you're just wasting time.
We've just been discussing this ad nauseum in my family because we're just coming through this college application process.
You're in the zone.
Right, I'm in the zone. Not only my own son, who's 17, but my sister has a twin daughter and son, who also 17. So all three of them, we've been like herding these cats through this gauntlet for the last, you know, year. And my niece has been admitted to St. Andrews here in the UK and also to American colleges. And she is trying to decide how to do this, because it's not just, you know, Scotland versus America. It's liberal arts versus I decide right now what I'm going to do,
and
that's it.
Yeah,
and
it's a very different program.
She and in this she probably represents many other young people. She is just sort of waking up to her intellectual self. She hasn't been a committed student until the last couple of years, and now it's as if she's just at the starting line and she doesn't know which way she's going to go. And I think for somebody like her, to have that opportunity to take an art class or a philosophy class or a history class or, oh my God, this would be a shocker, but a science class, you know, she really needs that smorgasbord right now.
Yeah, that's not only desirable, it's a requirement. Whereas here, you know, you have to know at that age, I want to study Japanese literature, and I'm going for that program. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Anything else? And if
right.
you don't like that, well, start over.
Right, right.
Which is a huge thing to ask.
It is a lot to ask.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much with the sciences. But even science students, you know, we want them to read and we want them to think and maybe learn a language. And so, I don't know. I mean,
well-rounded people can't be bad.
That's right.
Thinking
the well-rounded generation.
Can't be bad.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Well,
and
the
I,
reading and the writing is key, no matter what field people go into, because writing, I think, is really degenerating across the board.
Turn your whisper into a shout. With Radio Gorgeous. Well, that's another thing that came up in your novel, which I would say a lot of things are touched upon, but are somewhat interconnected, is that the relationship of protester and sort of protestee has completely changed through social media.
Yes.
That she, even as the president and the person that they are protesting
That's
against,
right.
is 100% irrelevant.
It is,
almost.
And this is a really tough lesson for her to learn, that the protesters are not interested in talking to her. She may, as a student, have occupied the president's office to try to get her university to reverse a policy on some issue, but these students, they're talking to the media, they're talking to Facebook, they're talking on Twitter, they're, you know, probably another on Instagram, probably didn't say that, but they are talking to their peers next door and around the world. They could not care less about actually, or they seem not to care at all about implementing a change in the actual policy that they are protesting. And she, Naomi, wastes a lot of time waiting for them to come to her. She goes to them, she invites them, she cajoles them, she threatens them, she tries everything before it realizes, she realizes that she's not getting anywhere. And in the end, she starts talking to the media too, and then things really get bad.
That's another thing, and to me it was another iteration of what Douglas Sedgwick, who's the person who's writing, you know, this compendium on Webster, the Devlin Webster, says that every time there's a moment, you know, influence.
Yes, influence.
Influence speaks.
There's that devil.
Influence is this devil, and they have hijacked the influence.
Ah, that's an interesting way to put it. See, I just learned something else about my book. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And that, you know, and that which seems, I mean, we could also speak about politics today, that the facts really don't seem to be
matter. What an old-fashioned concept.
Yeah, exactly.
Where something was actually true or not true. Those were the days, right?
Yes. But also, speaking of which, something that was funny, that we know what, you know, things dawn on us as they dawn on her or we may get there before her, or we may be a step behind her. But one of the things I thought was nice that wasn't commented on, but was quite funny to me, was in the way that she comments after an example of her not believing her daughter was at all in any way capable of doing something, comments on all the parents that come into her office and are just so shocked and appalled their child could possibly be, you know, the person who might do this.
That's right.
You know, and
well, you know, there's a parallel journey going on for her in this book, which is the journey of all of us as we let go of our children, as they hopefully leave for university or the world. Our relationship with them changes, and our relationship with ourselves changes, and that's, you know, that's hard for all of us. But that is another story that is going on with Naomi as she lets go of her daughter Hannah, who she's raised alone.
Mm. Tell me, one of the things we don't know, and I was just wondering what the role was in the idea that we don't know all of Naomi's backstory. We know general bits.
Yeah, well, that may be because I wrote an earlier novel featuring Naomi Roth. Now, I don't make a big thing of this because this book is not a sequel. You don't have to have read the earlier story. You don't, you know, I think sequels are icky and I don't like reading them myself. It's too much work. Even if you've read the first book, you worry that you have to go back and read it again to refresh your memory. Who has the time for that? But I've been very gratified. A few people, and I mean a few people, because not many people read the earlier novel, have sort of gotten in touch and said, oh, I'm so happy to see her again. Well, Naomi Roth was the protagonist of my second novel, The Sabbath Day River, in which some events that may be alluded to rather, you know, cryptically in The Devil and Webster are fleshed out somewhat. So if you really, you know, if you get to the end of this book and you're like, who is this woman and why, how did she end up where she ended up? If you have any idle curiosity in that direction, you can go and find. Actually, it was published in the UK back in, I'd say about 2000 by Macmillan. And it's probably knocking around like the Oxfam bookstore, which I was just in earlier today. So go to your nearest Oxfam bookstore or you can find it somehow. But part of it was that I didn't want to retell that story, mm-hmm. so I didn't allude to it, but it's all there.
Tell me about something you do in the States, book the writer.
Yeah, well, my husband Paul and I moved from Princeton, New Jersey, where he teaches, into New York City 3 years ago. I'd grown up in New York, and so it was a homecoming for me. And in Princeton, I'd been running this Meet the Author book group. And everybody would read the book, just like a normal book group, but the author would be there, which was really special. So when I moved back to New York, I thought, if there's any place on the planet this might work as a business, it would be New York City, because there are so many writers there. And, you know, you're not asking them to get on a plane or a train or drive. They could just come uptown on the subway.
New Yorkers,
yeah, we don't drive. But so when I moved back home, I started this group. It's called Book the Writer, and I represent over 100 novelists, memoirists, humor writers, food writers, poets, nonfiction writers, and they're all available to go to your book group, provided your book group is in and around New York City. We also run our own author book groups. We call them pop-up book groups, and individuals can register for them, and they, you know, they pay a small fee, and then we tell them where to go. They're hosted in people's apartments. So last week we had one with Sheila Kohler, who is a wonderful novelist and memoirist, whose new memoir is called Once We Were Sisters, and that was fantastic.
Another Radio Gorgeous guest.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, she's terrific.
Yes, she is.
And we're about to have one with Minjin Lee for her second novel, Pachinko, which I'm reading now. It's unbelievable. And, you know, we do about 20 of those a year.
I was going to say that it has everything New Yorkers love. real estate because you get to go poke around somebody's apartment.
Of course. Right? People have said that to me. I love the authors. I love the books. But I love being in people's apartments. And we've had some really spectacular apartments, too.
Oh, fantastic.
Because, you know, they have to have big living rooms. So.
Exactly.
And if we have a small group, I just host it at our house. Mm-hmm. Somewhat less spectacular.
And you are here in London, obviously, to do some promotion for the book, but also mudlarking.
That's right, my dirty secret. A few years ago, I wrote a travel story for the New York Times about mudlarking in the Thames, which is something I'd always wanted to do, and I came over and I spent a fantastic day with this guy called Steve Brooker, who he starred on a History Channel UK TV show called Mud Men, and he took me out, and it was unbelievable. I loved it, and every time I've been back, I've brought my Wellingtons, they're right there, and I go down to the Thames at low tide. I've got the tide tables today.
Excellent.
In my bag, and I'll be out there picking up probably little bits of old china
pipes
and things like
and
that. Love
oyster
the pipes.
Shells,
yeah.
And, yeah,
it's just such a, you know, it's not for everybody, obviously. The first thing you see when you go down there is like a used condom or a syringe, and you know, all right-minded people would turn around and leave right there, but not me. So I love the history, and I love that for 900 years Londoners have been, you know, chucking stuff in the river and or having it fall off and drop in the river, and there's just, you never know what's down there.
Excellent. Thank you very much, and I hope we get to say the same thing about your future writing. We
Thank
never
you.
Know what's down there.
We never do.
Bring it on up.
That's right.
For more about Henpicked, go to henpicked.net. Brought to you by RadioGorgeous.com.